not even the reviews. It's just, I think certain people see the movie and just want to attack it just because it doesn't fit an agenda that, for some reason, you know, is kind of implied to exist today, which, to me, is fine. I don't really, you know, that's, you make every movie you make, you wouldn't make a movie about a racial interracial custody battle and expect everybody to agree with your point of view on it.
Sure.
Let's get this thing out of the way first. I know that there's some people say that it's that black and white is too ambivalent in terms of advancing the politically correct narrative that all Hollywood movies are expected to advance, like, you know, like Selma and like other forward-thinking films, and that it lacks you know, it's somehow advancing some sort of vaguely racist attitudes. Particularly because of a term that Kevin Costner uses, which might as well just say it, street nigger is what it is, but it's done in a certain context. But let's just get one thing out of the way, which is that Mike is coming from a personal place, and I thought if you could just explain, Mike, that you have your own background with having raised a mixed-race kid in your own home.
Yeah.
And so on.
Yeah, that's right. And he had my nephew who we raised when his mother died. At 32, of a bad blood transfusion at the height of the AIDS crisis. And his father wasn't in his life, and he still isn't to this day. He's still in our life. You know, he's 34 now. But he had a wonderful family down in South Central that was part of my nephew's life, you know, and really he grew up in two worlds. And I just always thought that was a really interesting way to look at race relations in this country, not when people are arrested or a politician or a speech someone gives, but when people are more or less forced to be family together, and which is happening in a crazy amount. I mean, there are so many biracial marriages and biracial children in this country, interracial marriages and biracial, that I just thought it would be a great way to look at it. You know, I wasn't looking to make any definitive statement on race. I was just thought it would be an interesting story to tell and a good conversation starter about race in this country, you know?
Did you ever...
I agree that in a different, you know, coming out in a different environment, I think you're probably right. I think if this movie had been made and were coming out in the same social circumstances as something like Crash, then you would have a more constructive grounds for conversation. I think what's happening right now is that your movie is hitting at a point when there's a lot more anger in the conversation, and there's a feeling. You know, even today, as the protests about the Eric Garner failure to indict are happening, you're getting pushback from black leadership saying to whites, I don't want you co-opting our movement. And unfortunately, this is the environment into which your film is being released. I think a lot of the pushback that Jeffrey is perceiving doesn't stem as much from what he sees as a sort of doctrinaire PC desire for a particular narrative, which... I don't think, you know, Jeffrey can't really outline what this fantasy narrative he thinks the left is demanding ought to be. But, you know, right now we're in a more Dutchman moment than we are in a Crash moment or a black or white moment, which is unfortunate. I refer, of course, to the Roy Jones play.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
First of all, there's nothing, you know, there's nothing I can do about that, but we weren't in that when I wrote it or when we made it. But, and the other thing is when it came out of Toronto, and people like this guy from the IndieWire who just wrote this hateful screed about white man's, you know, the movie being an excuse for white man's racism and oh, you know, that we weren't even in this Ferguson era yet, you know, it hasn't really heated up. So a lot of it is just, here's the thing, you know, everybody says they want to have a conversation about race in this country, as long as it's the conversation they want to have, you know, and I understand that. I understand the anger that people are feeling and dealing with, and I couldn't even begin to try to imagine what it'd be like to be a young black guy in this country, you know. And but by the same token, you know, you can't make a movie trying to be politically correct, you know. And we didn't, you know, we made a conscious choice to say this is the story we want to tell, and yet, you know, there was. I won't tell you, but there were several actors that didn't want to do the movie because of the character, the son.
Reggie
was a drug addict, and I would say to them when we'd sit, I'd have coffee with them, I'd say, would you rather him be a nuclear scientist? Would that make it feel realer to you? You know, this is the real situation. It's not saying that all black, you know, black men are drug addicts and aren't raising their kids, but this is one that is, and that's what this is about. This is a family movie. Every family has a bad egg, you know, and this is a wonderful family, you know, and they happen to have one of the sons who, and they all know it. That's the problem.
The reason I brought up the PC mandates that I believe are out there is precisely because the various actors told you, Mike, that they don't want to be playing a guy with negative characteristics, which sends the wrong message, and that the whole general thing is that African American culture wants to present itself in a forward, positive, constructive, healthy, moving forward in life light, and they don't want to go in those territories. Now, you're not saying that it's endemic, but you have, I presume, noticed it and observed it in your dealings with a mixed race child, so I'm guessing that's where it came from, right? Or is that what you're telling me?
That it came. I guess, you know. And plus, I'm not stupid. I live in the world and I see it. I mean, I don't think the day to day. I think it's very different day to day on the street how people are, black and white people relate to each other than we see in the media. And not discounting the anger and the streets or anything that's going on in New York and Ferguson, but
I think that what still, in what Glenn,
a small group of black people, you know, I mean, there's a whole, you know, but my problem with a lot of far left writers and reviewers, mostly white, you know, there's a few black people that have had a problem with it, but mostly it's white writers, is they're looking at black people in a very monolithic way, which is the farthest thing in the world from that. I mean, as much as varied as white people are in their opinions and their culture and their attitudes, black people obviously are just as much. I mean, and that's the other side of it, is this movie, I have never seen it played badly to a black audience. And I've seen it play to a lot of black audiences.
And it got, it was listed on a recent Black Critics film list of Best of the Year or something. Well, didn't they do that yesterday or something?
Yeah, we made their top 10 in October.
Right, well, just by saying that, you're admitting that there's not a real monolithic form of opinion there. And if you look at the credits of your film, the credits of your film itself is a sort of model of integration. You've got Terrence Blanchard doing the score. You know, you have a really great cast of African-American actors, including Andre Holland, who's amazing in the role of Reggie. He is so good at sort of doing that puffed-up insistence on dignity and then just falling back into a position of humiliation that not every actor can toggle between those two and make that character so convincing.
Oh, he's a brilliant actor. He's a trained Shakespearean actor. You know, that's why we cast him, you know. But my point is, if you read some of these reviews, or even the non-reviews, you know, the guys like David Poland who just ignored it because he hated it, and I guess he because he's a semi-decent guy. He didn't want to trash us. There's so much that you could get behind in this movie. Exactly what you said. The model of integration, just working together with all these great artists, you know, and how hard it is to make a movie, you know, for Costner to actually have financed a movie with about white and black people. Why do you think nobody wanted to do it? Because it's like, oh, you're not going to play the white people, you're not going to play the black people, you know.
And I think his performance has nuances that people aren't properly acknowledging. You know, there is a streak of racism in that character, in just the way he reacts to people, the kind of condescension he shows to Devon upon first meeting him, the incredibly dismissive way. I mean, it's coming from a place of pain and anger associated with the fact that she's the mother of Reggie, but the way that he's so just sort of hand-wavingly dismissive of Wee Wee at first, and, you know, had he acted differently, he might not have been ensnarled in the thing that he gets ensnarled in. So I think your writing and Costner's performance, there's a dimensionality to it that a lot of the negative reviews have not acknowledged. That's for sure.
Well, that's my point. But by the way, if I were black, they'd be acknowledging it. I guarantee it. And that's not me whining or crying. That's just the truth. As soon as you see this, you go, okay, a white guy wrote and directed this. You have the brakes on any ability certain people to acknowledge the subtlety of it, you know? And everything, you know, you write it, you know, the best way. Listen, Glenn, I had the same thing. I don't know what you think about it or not. On another thing, I did a show, Mind of the Married Man, and, you know, there were people that I would read these reviews, and this thing is so horrible and puerile, and it's the worst show ever on television. And invariably, you know, over the years, you meet this writer who wrote about it. What did you hate about it so much? Oh, my husband had an affair, and he left me for this. And I know how fucking fucked up men are. Okay. Well, you know what I'm saying? I mean, that's the thing. You can't do a movie about race, or you can't do a movie about a married man's sexuality without knowing that people that are going to support it or tear it down are going to be doing it based on preconceived notions and issues in their life.
Why did you decide, Mike, to use that trigger term in that line of dialogue, this street nigger term? What was that? I mean, you knew it would be inflammatory, it'd get a reaction. What was the thinking? Because Glenn had this reaction, if I'm not misdescribing. You said it was a kind of a flag to those out there. You thought it was a...
Yeah, I think you misunderstood something I said. I was referring to you know, and I don't have it in front of me, unfortunately, but I think I was giving you more shit than the movie.
Okay.
That's a long story short.
But what's your feeling then? What reaction did you get from the hearing that term, and what did you think, think Mike's motive in using it?
Well, you know, it's pretty clear in the movie, you know, he comes out with it, he means it to hurt, and he realizes later, you know, in the cold light of day, and the fact that it's being used against him, that, you know, not only was it wrong to do tactically, but it was wrong to do, you know, in a larger sense. But, you know, you're never going to satisfy everyone, and I think that you know, the rationale comes out, and, you know, there's a rather deft bit of writing where there's some backstory involving texts from long ago that we don't have at the time that it comes out. I mean, and I don't want to sound like I'm being punitive. I don't want to use the term deck stacking, but there's something that there's a right, as a writer, you do things to you know, get the court of the dramaturge, at least, in your favor. So giving it that backstory after the fact is, you know, useful, but some people are going to raise their eyebrows at that. It's just a fact of life. I'd say overall, you know, I feel like the movie is actually more nuanced than the movie, I imagine, either both Jeff and the negative critics reacting to. I'll put it that way. And a lot of that has to do, too, with the direction, the performances, and the incredibly deft casting you've got going on there.
Mm-hmm. So what was your thinking in using that term, Mike? What was your thoughts about, with yourself, what was your dialogue about when you used that term in the script?
Well, I was just trying to make the movie very balanced and not make him, not be like, boy, they're so wrong. This guy, he's not even close to a racist look, you know, but he's not. You could see when he walks into the house, you know, downtown, how strongly they feel about him. And, you know, he's got a black secretary, and he's just not, but by the same token, he is a flawed guy, and he can say the wrong thing, and he has the wrong thoughts in his mind sometimes. And I just wanted to make sure that, you know, I was going, maybe, because Glenn might be right about the other side of it, is, stacking the deck back. I wanted to give him a good reason why he said it, but I didn't think that excused it. And I also thought, what I didn't want to do is make him really white, really pure in this thing. I wanted to make sure that, my goal of the movie was that it zigzagged it. This girl should definitely be with him. No, he should be down there. No, he should be up there. You didn't really know where he belongs, where the little girl belongs. And ultimately, what you come to is this family together should raise this little girl. She happens to have a lot of people that love her.
Yeah.
And if they were all the same color, they'd have gotten to that point without having to do a court case,
Yeah. And this reminds me of something, I don't know if you recall this, but many years ago, or, 15, 20 years ago, the British author Martin Amis was writing about the poet Philip Larkin, who was his godfather, and who came in for a lot of vilification after he died because of racist sentiments that he expressed in letters and private correspondence. And it's a huge mess, and his reputation took a bit of a beating, which is just starting to come back now. But Amis wrote, and I'm not phrasing it as elegantly as Martin Amis would, of course, but he said, people of my father's generation, Kingsley Amis, Philip Larkin, they grew up racist. They were kind of unabashed racist because that was kind of like their upbringing. People of my generation grew up less racist, but still racist because it's part of the atmosphere he grew up in. Hopefully my children will grow up even less racist. And, something like that will happen. I remember when I was a kid, very young kid in the 60s, and I learned the eeny, meeny, miny, moe, and, the kids who were saying it in the school were saying, they said it, catch a nigger by the toe. And I came home and I repeated that, and my mother, in very strong terms, says, no, you do not say that. I don't even know that she necessarily spelled out why. It was enough, my mother being a very formidable woman, it was enough that she said it, and, that was fine. But she knew enough through her upbringing that this was wrong. So, I think if there had been maybe, obviously it's in the writing and it's in the character, and I think a lot of people get a little confused because you have a sort of a personal redemption story along with a social story. But you might have been able to, and I think it's to your credit that you didn't, let people figure it out themselves. But, some people need hand-holding and some sort of thing where, you kind of acknowledge, okay, this generation is racist to a certain extent, but maybe the next generation won't be as racist. I don't know if you saw, Mike, did you see Dear White People?
That's what the movie's about, When President Obama came out the night of the George Zimmerman trial, or after, he said, the reason that I feel confident about racial relations, positive about racial relations in this country, is that my daughters are better at it than Michelle and I are, and I have two children who grew up here in Santa Monica, and these, my kids are really, it's amazing how close to truly colorblind they are. You know, they've just been raised that way. And my wife happens to be someone who is probably the least prejudiced woman I've ever met in my life. But my kids were just raised in this world, and some of their best friends are black or gay, or they don't care. They just, and they don't even talk about it. They don't care. They're friends with people based on what kind of people they are, not who they are. So that's why I freeze frame on the very end of the movie on the little girl, and that's what the movie's about to me. Where, you know, the reason that you're sensitive about race, I can tell you right now, is because you had a mother who, when you came home and said, catch a nigger by the toe, you said, wait a minute, that's not the way you talk. But, and in another house down the street, there was a mother that went, okay, that's funny, ha ha ha, you know? And it's totally, right now, I think the worst thing that's going on as a result of a lot of the anger out there is you're either teaching kids love or hate. And I think right now kids are being taught hate again.
Yeah.
That's a mistake. That's a big mistake. And that's what the movie, my goal for this movie, I love 12 Years of a Slave. As a slave, I'm sure Selma's a great movie. I haven't seen it yet. But I wanted to do a thing about, okay, so what, now what? Where do we go from here? And the answer is, A, the children, and B, you know, the best shot at people living together are people that are in these biracial families, and these families having to get along with each other.
Yeah. Hey, Matt, did you see Dear White People yet?
No, I haven't seen it.
It's an interesting movie because it's a, you know, it's a social satire. It's pretty I think to the extent that I think it indulges in a certain amount of caricature, but it also kind of reaches the exact same conclusion as your film, only on a smaller scale, with a biracial couple kind of giving off a "we got to live together" vibe. So, you know, it's kind of interesting, these two different films from two different directors of different races, and kind of getting to the same point at the end, which I think is encouraging.
No, well, I'll see it, you know, but my only thing, you know, where I was talking to Jeff was just the total dismissal of Kevin Costner's, who gave I think, an incredible performance in this film.
He did a
good
job.
I mean, every person that's seen it, and I've seen it with so many audiences, and they're so moved by it. And I know as an actor, it's a very, very hard performance to get away with and to do. And he's not a drinker, so to play the right level of drinking. But I feel there's a lot of people are just dismissing him because they don't think the movie is the right movie.
Well, another thing I didn't mention, Mike, is the besides the street nigger term, is he is asked on the stand in the court finale, do you have a problem with black people? And his response is, not all of them, which is another way of saying, yeah, most of them, but not all of them. That's a pretty racist thing to say. I think people are probably flinching at that kind of sentiment also, and obviously it's the same thinking that led you to put in certain thorny elements into his personality, which I completely
see. I see that moment exactly the opposite of what you just said.
Okay.
He said, do you have a problem with black people? He said, not all of them. He said, no. He's saying, no, not as a blanket rule. No, just the ones that I have a problem with. You know,
right.
Just the ones that I have. You can get mad and have a problem with a black guy and not hate all black people.
Yeah.
That's what he was trying to say.
Okay.
You know, and he was. It's also when you ask someone that question on a stand, you're obviously looking for a confrontation. So you know, I could have given a million mouth response. No, of course I don't. But when, you know, he, this guy was too angry and his back was too up, and he wasn't going to give him the benefit of the doubt there. He wanted to say what he felt. No, of course I don't have, not all black people, but if I have a problem with a black person, I have a problem with, you know? And, you know, and I hear what you said, and I would like to see gay white people, but
yeah, no, it's funny because the after he gives that speech, his friend, his protege, the lawyer, says, you know, I, and you know, he's being facetious, but it's an interesting counterpoint. And I'm glad you put it in there because it gives you something to think about, even though he's being hard on him when he says, you know, I have never seen a Klan member who could be that articulate. You know?
it's a right. I was, and also, I, you know, I was looking for a laugh there, and I knew it needed it. But by the same token,
it's a good laugh, but it's a thought-provoking laugh too, because you wonder the, you know, you wonder you are meant to think about the hidden depth there. And that, you know, when we talk about history, you know, the history of black oppression goes hand in hand with the history of white racism.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But I also, you know, here's the thing. That was also, again, Costner's character's a flawed guy, you know, and he lost his temper on the stand, and he spoke what was in his mind, and obviously he does have racist tendencies, but he's not a racist. He's just these thoughts, you know. When he says, you know, your nephew's broken down black ass, that shouldn't have come out, you know. But by the way, Anthony Mackie won that case in that moment because he was the better lawyer. The whole notion of Anthony Mackie, he was like saying to his sister, I'm a lawyer. My job is to win. If you come to me, you want me to win, I'll win. But I'm going to win, and I'm gonna paint him as a guy that doesn't like black people, and I'm going to get him to lose his temper. And that's the scene before Kevin's lawyer says to him, he's going to come at you, and he's going to try to get you to lose his temper, and Kevin goes, "Really? God, don't talk to me like I'm a child."
Yeah.
And then he does it. So, in my mind, he lost that case. And if the kid hadn't come to his house that night and reverted back to his old behavior, they'd have gone into court the next day, and the judge would probably have given the father custody.
And that judge is the actor who plays the judge. What's her name?
Paula Newsom.
She's terrific.
Yeah, I like her.
She's great.
I think one thing we can all agree on, and I think this is maybe where the heart of Jeff's feelings regarding the reaction to this film are concerned, you know, that traces of racism, tinges of vestigial racism in white people are not the same thing as institutional racism, and to not be able to make the distinction is problematic. I mean, I feel like I can probably learn from people who don't make that distinction, that maybe I need to work harder myself. But when we're talking about a work like this, you know, then it gets, then I think, you know, people are best served by looking at the distinction the work makes, which I think you do.
Yeah, but you know, well, thank you, and I think you're right. You know, I think you do. We have to figure out what that distinction is. You know, like I always say, if I'm sitting on a bus bench, and a young Mexican kid sits down with a boombox playing loud Mexican rap, and I don't like it, and I ask him to turn it down, I get mad. I don't not like Mexicans. I just don't like loud Mexican rap music blasting in my ear. You see what I'm saying?
Uh
I know. You know, Michael O'Donoghue, the late comic who Jeff is a great admirer of, he used to like to go to Washington Square Park with a boombox and blast classical music.
That's really funny.
That's a true story.
Who did that?
Michael O'Donoghue.
Oh, yeah. That's really great. But, you know, for me, it's just, I was just on this, and you always, you know, just as a filmmaker, and so you're always a little naked. You throw your movie out into the world, and you want people to love it. And when they don't, you kind of go, you look for an excuse why, you know, to be honest.
Sure.
But you know, we made this movie so independently, and I think we made a really brave movie. And I think his performance is so good. I'm kind of surprised when we came out of Toronto, just that either the vitriol or the utter dismissal, you know, with the exception of, you know, Jeff and Pete Hammond and a couple other people. Rex Reed wrote a nice thing, but most people just ignored it, you know, and that wasn't what the audience did. I mean, the audiences every time have loved it. I mean, we've gotten so many standing ovations and so many audiences, white and black, have lined up to tell us thank you for doing this movie, and just the ignorant, like I told Jeff, I set up to do an interview with David Poland. And I got a call, it's just canceled. You know
what, what really does burns my ass out? Glenn is implying that I'm kind of making it up in my head, but he knows that you cannot say Eric Garner was being argumentative and physically resistant and, you know, pushing things to the point that the cops felt they had no choice but to try and subdue him. Did they do it correctly? No, they horribly screwed it up, and the guy was an asshole for doing that, you know, for putting his arm around his neck and causing his heart to fail. Was awful. But, you know, Garner did aggravate the situation, but you can't say that. I'm going to get people
Louder.
You
just did.
Huh?
You just did say it.
I know, but I said it, and I'm going to get, you know, some shit for it because you can't say that. And it's implied that I'm kind of a racist because it's obvious that the guy's obviously trying to resist and make something happen. He's all, but leave me alone, get out of here. You know, everything is, you know, the cops are entirely the bad guys because, and they did do
it. You want to bring your sense of personal grievance because people don't treat your pronouncements with the respect you think they deserve. You know, I could bring up the fact that you talk about Martin Luther King and his homies, which is about the most condescending thing you could say. I mean, it's all part, you know, it's part of the way you put your tone out there, and you like to mix it up. And if you can't take the mixing it up, maybe don't use the kind of language that you use.
What's wrong with saying...
I disagree with you, but also nobody's saying that you can't say it. They just give you shit back because they think you're giving shit.
What's wrong with
that? Now, you want to stir things up, that's what you got to deal with.
It's also...
You have no sympathy for me on that, and, you know, you can't use lynching as a metaphor. It's like, you're not a martyr. You get to get up and you get to write your website every day, and you get paid for it. Nobody's messing with your business.
And also, you know what, I also got... because I was trying to extend the idea of how I have been treated in a certain way all my life, whenever I mention to any woman who has any passing interest in astrology that I am Scorpio. As soon as I say that, I get, you know, prejudicial reactions. They presume that
you're going way above my pay grade here, Jeff.
What? You don't know about... I'm just trying to say what I did briefly. Very briefly. Go ahead, Mike. I'm sorry.
The problem is that brings up images of all those Scorpio-only washrooms in the South.
There you go.
You're also
the shameful astrological past. Yes.
And the politically correct militants also get on your case if you mention the liquor store video with Mike Brown. That is your problem. You're being, compassionate enough. You're.
Oh boy, Mike, are we ready to handle this stuff? Can we really take on all these problems at once?
I'm just saying, you're trying to make it seem like it's kind of in my head. I'm trying to imagining it, and I know what happens when you say, listen, the guy was obviously belligerent. There's obviously trouble in doing this. People on the PC left immediately discount any and all indications of problematic behavior on the part of the victims prior to their ghastly and horrific death.
But there is a double standard. I mean, you talk about I occasionally drove drunk and it was like really badass, but no harm done.
Well, that's true.
Somebody could just as easily say, well, you know, you could do a lot more damage doing that than stealing cigars from a liquor store. And, you're trying to create this paradigm where, whatever good qualities Mike Brown might have had are completely, whatever potential he had to reform or do better or what have you, are completely subsumed by this demonization, part of which is driven by the iconography of the indestructible huge black dude. So I'm not going to roll over and say, oh, poor Jeff, you're taking a hit really bad. You know, you think like if it's like Tinkerbell, if you clap enough, she'll come back to life. If everybody admits that Mike Brown was a sociopathic thug, then we could have social progress in this country. I'm not buying it, Jeff. You can play martyr all you like, but this is pretty lame in my.
You know perfectly well, Glenn, that if you're in a liquor store in North Bergen, where I was living for over a year, and some guy came in and pulled that shit and stole something and pushed the store owner and everything, you would not be. Oh, that guy's cool. You know, maybe he probably has some other good qualities.
Jeff, he maybe deserved to be arrested.
Huh?
Yeah, he should be under arrest.
Okay, so I'm just saying nobody wants to go there.
But Glenn, I mean, the truth is, when the cop pulled him over, the truth is, there is a truth to it that he should have just said, okay, whatever you want. Well, there's no upside in...
Believe me, I know there's no upside in arguing with cops. I mean, I've lived all the time, I know there's no upside to that. But,
And I think that all Jeff's saying, and he's right. Sometimes you can't even say that. It's just like we're in a state. But also, to be fair, we're in the middle of a storm, and that's something. I don't need to say that because times are we're bleeding right now.
Yes, exactly. I agree with Mike. There's what can be said, and there's what ought to be said. And what is necessary to be said? What is necessary to be said right now? That's the thing, and that's what I was saying before when I was talking about this is a moment with a lot of anger. So how are we gonna absorb the anger? How are we going to understand the anger? What are we gonna do with the anger? That's all. I like the fact that your movie ends on a healing note, but healing is not. Just a matter of willing it.
Yeah, that's right. But I will say, listen. If you want, just go and look at the people's reaction on Facebook and Twitter to the trailer. I mean, it's just one after another. Women go, I can't wait to see that. We need this right now. Even though we're in the middle of a storm and people are hurting over on both sides over what's going on out there in the streets, even in the middle of that, you can see there's a whole group of people that don't want to live and die by current events. They want to figure out a way. They're hungry to see characters and a story that does have a healing aspect to it. And ultimately, black and white, if anything, it might be that it's too tame. It's a movie about family. That's all it is.
I think it deserves to be seen and it deserves to be talked about.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Interesting. You're still calling it black and white, which naturally you would, because that's what has been in your head, and you worked on it for so many months. But interesting.
What did I call it?
You just called it black and white, and the official title is black or white. And
I call it black and / or white.
Good stuff.
You know that, Glenn, you know, I don't know if you know the story, but the Seth Rogen, Kevin Hart.
Yeah, no, that's kind of odd.
Right. It's called Black and White, which, you know, I would be seriously surprised if they used that title, because it, you know, it does, it's a 1948 period comedy about the very first black cop, white cop pairing in a squad car in Los Angeles. And
yeah, Black and White was also the name of the Jim Toback movie from years ago.
Right, right.
Which was a rather more bollocking.
They're never going to use that title, and that's what that's kind of one of the things that was a little sad, because, you know, we said that to Paramount and we said it to Seth Rogen. You know, you're not gonna use the title, and then you're gonna stop us from using it. It's gonna be sad, you know. But they did, and you know, it's fine. I think Black and White's a better title.
Hey, what was Rogen's reaction? Was he like? Was it like Al Pacino talking to Tessio at the end of The Godfather? I can't help you.
I wasn't on the phone, but he told a friend of mine the story about it in a very kind of... Kevin Costner called me and tried to threaten me, and I told him what was what, you know?
There you go. So he didn't even afford you that respect. That's terrible.
There's also, Glenn, I don't know if you heard this story, but there's, you know, there's a Michael Mann cyber drama called Black Hat.
Black Hat, yeah.
And they tried to muscle these guys also. In fact, they were told you can't even use the title because it's too similar to Black Hat, and it'll get in the way of our, you know, commercial, you know, swing or something. And therefore, Costner had to find his way around that.
Titles, man, though, you know, just when you think you've got everything, all your ducks in a row, they start fucking with your titles.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't believe it. And not only that, we showed it, Brad Gray and what's the head of the, Adam Goodman and all the marketing people watched the movie, and they, you know, 6-8 months before, mm-hmm. we showed it to them, and they didn't say, hey, by the way, you can't use this title, you
right.
know?
Right. Yeah. The other thing about the politically correct gang that really bothers me about movies is that if a film is saying the right things, which Selma clearly is saying, telling a good story about heroism, about strength of character, about compassion, about the right thing, and people, and a lot of people saying, "Well, we want to do the right thing," and it's a good film to settle into, makes you feel good that you've seen it. There's a film that I've mentioned in my column called Mississippi Burning that Mike says he doesn't want to get into, it. But it's not a particularly ennobling story. It's full of lies and it gives you a wrong impression that somehow the FBI had the back of the civil rights movement, and FBI agents were exemplars of you know, human rights and dignity and whatnot, where in fact the FBI, particularly the Hoover leadership of the FBI, was very antagonistic towards the civil rights movement. But it's a better made film, and this is the other thing that ideologues never seem to want to accept, which is that if a film is better made, it has better chops, it's more engaging, it gets you better, the way Mississippi Burning does. And
in a completely different genre.
Yeah, okay, Mississippi Burning.
You know, Mississippi Burning is an action film that uses civil rights as a pretext. You know, Selma's a film about process.
Right.
So, I mean, you can prefer Mississippi Burning to Selma all you like, but to hold them up as, like, this is the better civil rights parable because it's more crackly is kind of nonsensical. They're not even in the same category.
Just pure craft, just good cinema. You know, it's dealing.
Well, you know, it's arguable that it's even good cinema because Alan, you know, there's a school of thought. You know, you quoted Pauline Kael, that thinks Alan Parker films are a lot of sensationalistic crap. You know, that he's like ones that you know, he doesn't even achieve a Tony Scott level of craft and just sort of throws explosions at the screen and is completely lurid. You know, Angel Heart. The blood dripping from the chicken sex scene and that, you know, he's a showman and not a particularly honorable one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, you know, you're entitled to prefer any film you want, but you can't act like it's, you know, David Bordwell film language gospel that Alan Parker is, you know, somehow a master of the craft in the same way that Scorsese is.
Glenn, you know, have you watched it recently? I have watched Selma twice, and I watched Mississippi Burning just out of curiosity. Yeah, I hadn't seen it in a while. I was immediately hit by, my God, this is the command in this film. The expert use of sound in just the right way, and the images, which are much more...
Yeah, I mean, you know, Alan Parker is a technically advanced filmmaker, but so is Michael Bay. You know, it's the means to which you use the ends, you know. And a lot of people find the Mississippi burnings just meretricious. You know, the only Alan Parker film I can really stand to watch is Shoot the Moon.
Yeah. I like Evita, actually. I think that's actually probably his best film.
Yeah, I can go down there.
What about, didn't he also do The Commitments?
Yeah.
Commitments is actually, you know, that's probably, yeah, that's close.
Yeah.
So.
That was pretty decent. I don't know, it's just, you know, it's the old one that this Manola Dargis about Triumph of the Will. This is an old PC argument, but she despises, obviously, as anyone would, anyone who coddled or glorified the fascist regime.
Right, if we unroll your Manola Dargis issues, we're going to be here for another 3 hours.
I'm just saying.
What'd you say?
Well, I'm just saying.
If we unpack Jeff's Manola Dargis issues, we're going to be here for another 3 hours.
Many people have said that they've acknowledged that Triumph of the Will, it's a very well-made, commanding film, but it's not something you're allowed to, you know, admire, even on the aesthetic level. Forget the horrible ideology and the repulsive, you know, ethos of Nazism. It's still a very well-made film, and people that are...
Well, it's well-made, but in a really incredibly trite fashion. I mean, the iconography, the fascist iconography is so... blunt that you could say this about Eisenstein's film too, that the Bolshevik ideology and iconography in Eisenstein's film is really blunt. A lot of those films, you know, they're not, you know, they're well made and they're incredibly crafted, but they're not, whether or not you find the ideology repellent, which in the case of Triumph of the Will, yes, it's repellent. It's also, they're also not terribly sophisticated.
Okay.
You know, not in the way that, you know, something about a Giga Vertov or something is.
Okay.
Anyway, it's a whole other kettle of fish.
All right. Okay, so is there something that we want to say in finality, Mike or Glenn?
I just want to say again, I think that Mike's film is a lot more nuanced than its detractors have been saying. You know, My own, whatever issues I have with it, you know, I didn't want to, you know, fully articulate because I think that, you know, it's a good faith effort and it deserves to be seen and talked about. I just wanted to talk about, you know, as you asked, some of the reasons why some people are taking the umbrage that they're taking. But I hope it does enter the conversation at some point. That's all I want to end on.
All right.
And the only thing that I would like to say at the end is that bastard Alan Parker's a racist prick. he's held back the black people.
Well, yeah, and also, you know, see Black or White because of some great performances. Kevin Costner and Andre Holland are both, you know, not to take anything away from Spencer or Mackie or any of those guys, but those two guys give just really outstanding performances.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, I'm glad we did this.
Nice talking to you. Nice meeting you, Mike.
Yeah, you too, Glenn. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Okay. Be well, guys.
So long.
Take care.